You are listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is sponsored by Codify, a California benefit corporation. Visit Codify at www.codify.com. Hello and welcome to the Archaeology Podcast, Episode 3. I'm Chris Webster.
And I'm April Camp Whitaker. On today's show, we are talking to Dr. Bonnie Clark at the University of Denver about her work at Amachi, a World War II Japanese-American internment camp.
Let's dig a little deeper.
With us, Dr. Bonnie Clark of the University of Denver in Denver, Colorado. And she's going to be talking with us about her work and research at Amachi, which is a World War II Japanese internment camp. And this is a project that's very near and dear to my own heart because this is where I did my master's research and is now part of my dissertation work. So we're really happy to have you with us here today, Bonnie.
Well, it's an honor to be part of this, so I'm excited.
And could you just start out by giving us a short overview of what is Japanese internment?
Well, it is, first off, an unfortunate and shameful incident in American history. Certainly it's that. But essentially, there's a longstanding distrust of people of Asian origin in the United States. And we see that first with the immigration and then subsequent closing of the door to Chinese immigrants. And sort of the irony of Japanese immigration to the United States is that it really was in many ways made possible by the exclusion of another Asian group, which is the Chinese Exclusion Act, which was passed in the 1880s. That's about the same time that Japan is modernizing and people are starting to immigrate to the United States, as well as other areas, particularly into Hawaii, which at that point was a territory. And so with the bombing of Pearl Harbor, this kind of general anti-Asian sentiment really focuses and flares on Japanese Americans. And there is a concern that that Japanese might act as spies. The Japanese Americans in the United States might act as spies. And so that furor is really inflamed by certain newspapers, by union groups, some of them, certainly politicians who kind of, in some ways, almost use this as an excuse to do something they've been trying to do for a long time, which is to try to get the Japanese out of away from the west coast of the U.S. and particularly in California, where they had become quite successful at farming on land that other people were not interested in. And so there is, right after Pearl Harbor in February, Roosevelt signs what's called Executive Order 9066. And what it does is it gives the war authority the right to remove for an unstated amount of time, anyone who might be seen as a danger. And so what's interesting is that it doesn't say anything about Japanese Americans in the executive order, but it's pretty clear that that's who's going to be the target of it. And so they, the west half of the coastal states, so Washington, Oregon, California, and then the southern half of Arizona are designated as exclusion zones. And then there's a sort of time of voluntary relocation where Japanese Americans can leave, but most of them, you know, they don't have the resources or they're elderly, they've got farms to take care of. And so the army shifts and they do a forced evacuation. And then once it becomes clear that in the interior of the US, those governors don't want folks just being able to resettle, is that they realize that they're not only going to have to remove them, that they're going to have to incarcerate them, that they're going to need to be in these facilities. And so that's what Amachi is. It's one of the 10, what's called the War Relocation Authority. It was a civil authority that was in charge of the relocation and the confinement. And so there are 10 of these camps throughout the Western U.S., and one of them is located in southeastern Colorado, and that's where I've been doing the work since 2008.
Yep, Bonnie, I got a quick question for you while we were talking about how these things came about. Was there ever a recorded instance of a Japanese American doing something, I don't know, what they would have considered un-American to give them a reason to, you know, even one person to give somebody in the government a reason to say, yeah, we're doing this? Or was it just 100% fear-mongering kind of stuff?
It was really pretty much 100% fear-mongering. In
right.
fact, the fact that no, there was no what they call fifth column activity, meaning no espionage, was used against them to say, well, then they're just waiting for the right moment. And it's a case where different agencies argued, because particularly the Army intelligence and the Naval intelligence in particular suggested that so both first generation Japanese as well as second generation, so those who are born in the U.S. and who are citizens, which is 2/3 of the population at that time, were more patriotic than many of their neighbors. They were very committed to the United States. And so and they realized that the war authority, I mean, some of the folks in the Department of War really realized that this would actually have an adverse impact on their ability to fight the war, because the Japanese, you know, almost half of Japanese Americans were involved in agriculture, and food was incredibly important during the war to feed the troops as well as to make munitions. You've also got the fact that here are the people who actually know how to speak and read Japanese. You need them on your side. And so there was a real division, but those voices that were whipping up kind of fear and building on existing resentment just drowned out pretty much anybody else.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, how did you get interested in Amache? What got you over there?
Well, I was a relatively new here at the University of Denver, and I happened to read, it was a report done by a cultural resources management firm who'd been hired by a group of former internees to do a kind of reconnaissance level survey at Amache. And that was in part driven by the fact that it had been placed on the National Register, and there was some thought that it might be appropriate for it to be a National Historic Landmark, which is, you know, the highest recognition for a historic site in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And so that I read through that report, and I was just amazed by, you know, given that context that I just talked about, that people are being incarcerated because they're not American enough, that what we find are Japanese ceramics, that we find things like traditional style Japanese gardens. And so I was really interested in that. And that ties into my kind of longstanding interest in how people live out their identity, and particularly when that identity is under siege. And so I saw this as a really great opportunity to look at a really interesting, from a kind of theoretical point of view,
mm-hmm.
As well as a site that was about to become a National Historic Landmark, which was almost certainly going to mean more people, which means more impact to the archaeology. And so I wanted to kind of get in on the ground floor with the hopes that archaeology could really be well integrated into the interpretation that happens there, as well as the efforts at preservation and site development. And I think that has really come to bear.
Okay.
So Bonnie, you've been working at Amache since 2008. So what are you doing there currently? How does the research you're doing work?
Well, so what we've done is, and it's kind of evolved over the years, but essentially we have a biannual field school. So we hold it every other year. And that field school is kind of the linchpin of the project, but the project is ongoing. So the field school involves going down to Amache and working there, as well as the associated museum. And so we do archaeology in the morning, and then we help The local museum, which is actually run by a volunteer organization staffed largely by high school students, to help manage the collections, the really important collections that are related to the camp. And so we're down there for about a month. We live in the town of Grenada, which is about just over a mile away from the camp, and they're really key. And so this is, it's a community collaborative field school. So we have members of the local community who work with us, mostly these high school students. We also work with the high schoolers who are descendants of people who were at Amachi. And then we also have volunteers who are either former internees themselves or their descendants. And they work with us as volunteers and are really critical to that. So that field school happens, and it's a very intensive research that is, I have a kind of ongoing interest in landscape and in the gardens at Amachi. I'm actually working on a manuscript on that right now. And then we also incorporate in graduate student research. So we have an MA program here at the University of Denver, and every field season we've had at least one student, including that very first year, April, doing their thesis research there. So that's also incorporated into our research design, as is when we know there's going to be some kind of impact related to site development. For example, there's several structures that have been reconstructed, and we basically do Section 106 clearance of those parts of the camp while we're doing this kind of other engaged research. And then once the field school is done, those items that we've collected come back to DU, where then I teach with them in my historical archaeology class, and the students in that class do the artifact analysis and do the data entry on them. And then I also teach a class where my students work with community members, and they co-curate these objects and do an exhibit. So we've got a traveling exhibit that will hopefully soon also be an online one. And so the project lives in lots of these different ways. We also make sure that we are continually having a conversation with the sort of widespread descendant community and survivor community, which is largely in California because that's where people came from. So we're often going to California to talk to people, to do research, just to check in with them and make sure we're all heading in a direction that we all agree with.
Okay. You know, one thing you said in there, and I just want to clear this up a little bit, you mentioned that, you know, survivors and descendants come and help out in Grenada. They don't still live in Grenada, right? They didn't stay there after the camp closed. They're coming in from other places.
For the most part, but there were a few people who stayed in the Arkansas Valley. And one gentleman in particular who still lives there, although he's quite elderly, mm-hmm. So he's never volunteered with us. All our volunteers have come in from other places, but there was a population that did stay and a number who moved from camp to Denver. And so I work a lot, because I'm here, I work a lot with the folks in Denver who have an Amachi connection as well.
Hmm. Okay. All right, cool. Well, what do you see this, how do you see this as, I guess, important or interesting to a broader audience? Like, what can we learn from Amache?
Well, you know, there's really so many things. It's hard to know where to begin. I think one is to think about the fact that it's really interesting to see the way that people are invested in places. You know, prisons are, and that's where my work really ties into the work that's done at other sort of sites of institutional confinement, is that, you know, nobody wanted to live at Amachi, and yet they took what was really this bare scraped earth of a military facility and they turned it into a town, mm-hmm. with sidewalks and parks and trees and ball fields and a sumo pit and literally hundreds of gardens. And so I think it helps us think about the importance of placemaking, which is, you know, a really important anthropological topic. That specificity of the Japanese garden, you know, people love Japanese gardens, and there's a good reason for them. They are, you know, over a thousand years in the making in terms of their philosophy and a kind of refined sense of aesthetics and a relationship to nature. And so people are really interested in the gardens at the camp. I think that obviously we are still, as a country, struggling with how to understand where immigrants fit in, how they fit in, do they fit in, and especially when we have a racial element to that. Those questions about who belongs and who doesn't, and what happens when we let the balance between sort of national security and individual justice get out of balance, like what are the consequences of that? And so I think, you know, this research could not be more timely.
Okay. Cool. So I'm wondering, you mentioned, you know, the Japanese gardens that they made and stuff like that. And we've visited, me and my friend Michael, of course, as you know, we visited Omache out in June. And when you guys were there, and I was kind of amazed at some of the stuff that, I mean, even just the archaeological remnants, you could tell some of the things that they had done and constructed there. How much freedom, for lack of a better word, did the government give them to do stuff like that? I mean, aside from moving and leaving there, how much could they do to the place to kind of personalize it and make it their own? What you know, do we have records on that, on what they were allowed to do and what they weren't allowed to do?
Well, there's not a whole lot of records about that. But essentially they were that sort of, especially that space, the camp. Once you get into the area where the internees lived, they kind of had free rein. And in fact, you know, the police force at the camp was a volunteer force of internees themselves. They were self-policing. Oh. There was a sort of a Caucasian overseer, but otherwise they were kind of, you know, watching out and taking care of themselves. And so within that space, they could pretty much do what they wanted. And in fact, a big concern of everyone. So the Omache is located in Colorado, but it's less than 20 miles away from Kansas. So it is on the far high plains, and it's an area that was actually just coming out of the Dust Bowl as World War II started. Mm-hmm. So when they bulldozed that camp, they unleashed this fury of sand. And, you know, the wind is kind of always blows on the high plains. And then you add in the site is located on this sort of barely stabilized dunes that then they destabilized through the production of the camp. And so they actually, there was encouragement of landscaping. And so in some areas, you know, that were sort of public space that were big and open and didn't have any buildings, they actually planted ryegrass. The administration did, or paid people to, you know, internees to do it and maintain it. And there was official sort of landscaping in the camp plan in the administrative area of the camp. And so the internees were kind of free to do what they wanted to do. Now, and something that's interesting and it's important for people to realize is that even though these are, you know, prisons in a way, they've got a barbed wire fence, they have armed guards and guard towers, but they're also relatively porous in that it was pretty easy to get a work pass, and people are working in the farms that are associated with the camp that surround it. And so there are lots of people who every day are leaving that perimeter. Okay. And so when they're out and they're doing their work, they're gathering materials for gardens. So they're picking up cobble from the Arkansas River. They are digging up trees. They are finding cool cactus. And this is happening sort of in the immediate environs of camp. But then our research has shown that people are actually ranging a much broader, you know, 30 and 40 miles away. We're finding stones that have to come from at least that far away, because we don't have the geological formations are that far away from which such stones could be recovered. But we know that people are getting passes to work on local farms that are not part of the kind of project area. And so that mobility allowed them to pick up kind of cool stuff that they could come back and bring to the garden. In one instance in particular, there is a kind of real, like a city park that is next to a Machi town hall. So it was where each block had a manager that they were essentially an elected official. It's like your city councilman. Mm-hmm. And where they met, in the block where they met, there's this really beautiful garden. And for that garden, the administration actually let them take a truck and go down to the Arkansas River and collect river cobble and plants.
Nice. That's cool. It's so interesting how that whole LifeWay worked out there. It's kind of amazing. They were able to make something out of, you know, the situation they were given. Not that it was pleasant in any way, shape or form, but that they did something with it. We'll get into that a little bit more. And then some of the community archaeology aspects of what you were doing down there in Grenada when we come back from the break.
Hello, APN listeners. Today we have some exciting news. The Center for Digital Archaeology, PCS, and Codify have teamed up to create an exciting new online training program built especially for you. Visit digitaltraining.site and you can sign up for free interactive office hour sessions to get help and share ideas about everything from digital photography to drone usage in archaeology and even tips and tricks on how to prepare for your next job interview. We're offering deep dive, 2-hour webinars, and intensive single-day workshops so that you can truly level up your skills. This is cutting-edge training provided by experts in the fields of digital imaging, cultural resource management, business practices, and more. Courses will fill up fast, so visit digitaltraining.site today and see what we have in store for you. That's digitaltraining.site. We look forward to learning with you.
All right, well, we are back from our break to continue our conversation with Dr. Bonnie Clark about her research at Amachi. So, Bonnie, one of the things that I've found really great and interesting about working with your project is the fact that it's blending all of these different communities where we have students coming from multiple universities, we have members of the descendant and former internee Japanese American community, and we have students and community members from the town of Grenada who all work with us. It's sort of this really fascinating community archaeology project. So could you talk a little bit about what community archaeology is and why it matters in the field of archaeology?
Well, you know, I feel like in some ways, I mean, all archaeology or so much of it is community archaeology, right? I mean,
or should
very
be.
Rarely, yeah, it should be. But I mean, very rarely do we work by ourselves. Mm-hmm. We're working with other people. It's essentially a team project. And the question is, who is on your team? And how can you use that inherently collaborative structure of our discipline to its best ability? And so community archaeology is I think, just a really conscious attempt to be thoughtful about how are the different ways that we can incorporate more voices and more different people, and especially the people who have, you know, who really care about this and who have expertise into the work that we do. And so with the Amachi project, it's just so natural because we have, you know, we have descendants. Not just descendants, which a lot of, you know, archaeology has, but we also have survivors. So we have people who remember this past. And it was always really important to me that this project be respectful of and also incorporate people's knowledge so that we're not just kind of starting from scratch. And then and incorporating the local high schoolers is just also so key. First off, one of the things about community archaeology is then you, by incorporating people, then you have much more, you've got all this support, you know, people who are invested because they've worked with you and they have seen what archaeology can do. And so you don't have to argue about why it's important because they see it every day when they do it. And so we have just incorporating the local high schoolers in particular is great because they know about the local history. They know about the local geology because a lot of these kids are farm, you know, they're farm kids. And they've also, because they live with this history and they know it, and they also really importantly, in terms of managing the materials at the museum, you know, they're the ones who man that museum when we're not there. And so knowing what they do with them and what their needs are is really important for us to be, to do, you know, a kind of appropriate curation. And so to me, community archaeology, I think we have, sometimes it's been cast as kind of, well, it's, you know, it's that add-on and it's a thing that, you know, makes it look like we've, you know, ticked that service box. But to me, community archaeology is good science. It's not just being a good citizen, but the more we have all these people involved, the better we do our job, the more data sources we have access to, and especially if we're concerned about the long-term preservation of our cultural resources, it's absolutely key.
You know, I get a kind of a follow-up to that. Amache's, the site itself is pretty much open to the public, right? I mean, you can just drive up there and go in and check it out, right?
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. So that's part of the reason why being open about what we do. And, you know, we have a specific open, we have two open house days every summer, one of which is really designed for the, we advertise it very much locally and we try to get local folks to come in so they can see what we're doing and they can understand why it is that, for example, it matters where an artifact is found.
Right.
And that's important in a site that's open to the public, that where people are understanding why they shouldn't be collecting. And also they, you know, they are, you know, pride in the importance of this site because they, you know, they are its stewards. And then we also have an open house day that's specifically for people who have a personal or family connection to the camp. Mm-hmm. And something that I've been really proud about is the fact that we draw in, you know, descendants of former internees and former internees themselves, but we also draw in descendants of people who worked in the camp.
Oh my.
Which is great. You know, people whose parents were teachers, for example. And so that is, to me, important that we are having the kind of dialogue where everybody feels like they have a role to play.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What is the current status of Amache? You may have said this in the beginning, but I can't remember it. What is it to, I mean, it's not a, is it a national site of some significance? I mean, what, I mean, I know it has significance, but what is its official status?
Its official status is that the National Historic Landmark.
Okay.
But it is still, you know, that doesn't mean that that it's federally owned. It's just federally recognized. So it is owned by the town of Grenada.
Okay.
And so, and they do, you know, they manage it and they get some help from the county in terms of like keeping the roads up, but really it is a labor of love, especially by the high school students who, and their leader, John Hopper, who is the a social studies teacher and now the principal of the school, who, you know, makes sure that the grass is mowed at the site cemetery, for example. Mm-hmm. And that when people come who want to either visit the museum or visit the site, if they, especially if they've got a tie to it, that they, you know, that, that they're guided through the resources.
Is there any movement to get it federally recognized or owned? Because I know, I mean, I lived in North Dakota for 5 years, and the only thing anybody ever talked about was how all the small towns are getting smaller and smaller and smaller because, you know, kids are getting out, they're going to college, and they're realizing that there's a huge wide world out there, and they don't want to live in their small town anymore. So the small towns keep shrinking and shrinking, and I'm just wondering, I mean, this is maintained by the town on a volunteer basis and people do all these things, but as those people stop doing that, you know, it would need some sort of federal recognition. So is there any movement in that direction or even a desire to do that?
You know, there is actually, and it's been interesting as the journey has progressed, something that's really critical to the site and the reason why the town owns it is because of the water. So, you know, anywhere in the West, water is incredibly important. And the War Relocation Authority, you know, there were over 7,000, about 8,000 people who lived at the camp in any one time.
Hmm.
And so that's a lot of people to, you know, make sure that they have water to shower and to drink. And so there were very deep wells that were dug by the War Relocation Authority. And so that when the town purchased the camp, they purchased it for the water rights. And so that has been a sticking issue, but there are now more and more kind of parks that have collaborative agreements with either with local landowners or other folks. And so once the negotiation, it was clear that the town would be able to maintain their water rights, they have, the town at least is now interested in pursuing that. And they've been working with one of our local congressmen, Corey Gardner, and you know, that they're hoping to move forward a suggestion of it being to become a National Park Service unit. There are two other historic parks in the region. So there's Bent's Old Fort, and there's also the Sand Creek Massacre. And so what it would be is a problem, and those operate jointly. And so probably what would happen would Amache would join those as the three. And it, there is a kind of connected history between all of them. Interestingly enough, so Amache is actually named for Amache Ochene Prowers, who is was Cheyenne, and she was married to John Prowers, and the site is in Prowers County. So it's kind of named, it's in honor of her. Her father was killed at Sand Creek.
Okay.
And one thing we should quickly clarify too, if you're home and looking up Amache online, you'll also see it referred to as the Grenada Relocation Center. But because it's the relocation center internment camp was called Grenada and a mile from the town of Grenada, the residents, the internees actually decided to change the name and called it Amache, after Amache Ochene Prowers, to distinguish between the two communities because they were having problems with things like mail going to the wrong post offices. So if you're home and trying to do more research on this, you can try both of those names and that will pull up some different results for you.
And we will have some links in the show notes as well that you can just click over to this page and find some of this information at least.
Yep.
Okay, so moving on, I'm wondering. Well, first off, just a comment because you know when we drove out to Amache, it's not exactly on the beaten path, if you know what I mean. I mean, southeastern Colorado in general is not exactly, you know, a tourist destination for what people would kind of think of, you know, stuff like that. And as a contrast, I've driven up and down Highway 395 here in California, Nevada, on the way down to Bishop, California. It kind of 395 skirts the eastern edge of the Sierra Nevada mountains. And one place that I pass every time I've done that, and I've done it dozens of times, is Manzanar. And that's another relocation center. And I'll tell you what, now this one's proximity to the to a well-traveled highway probably helps it for people visiting and learning about it. But everybody I know that's gone there has just been deeply impacted by that site. And every time you go by there, it doesn't seem to matter what time of year it is. There are cars in that parking lot, lots of cars in that parking lot. And it is... I can't remember. It's not a national park, but I know it's in the, I think it's pretty sure it's in the NPS system. And I know that because my wife has a little passport stamp book things you can get from there. And Manzanar has a stamp. So it's in their system somehow. But that, that definitely helps drive, that designation helps drive traffic there, I'm sure. So people can go and learn about it. And I guess it helps for Amache that there are other things in the area as well, because man, is it, it's difficult to get to, isn't it? You've done that drive quite a few times, I'd imagine, Bonnie.
Oh yeah. I kind of have every landmark memorized on the way. You know, it does feel very out of the way. But you'd be surprised by how many people come to Amache. Something that really helped. And this is just for any site manager out there, if you want more people to see your site, make sure there's a sign on the highway as you're leading up to it. Because for a long time, there was just a sign right at the turn, and it was just super easy to drive by. And so a lot of the county commissioners and the folks in Grenada, and then, you know, those of us in Denver, you know, tried to help push it along, was just this getting that official, you know, the brown sign that says it's a historic site on the highway. Mm-hmm. And like with a couple of blocks lead time on either side so that people could slow down.
Right.
And turn in. And Highway 50, although it's not, you know, it's a two-lane highway, it's actually a really important, especially for people who are going from like Kansas and Texas to California and Arizona. So it is one of those that, you know, if people are doing that kind of blue highways tour of the U.S., they do go through there. And it is, you know, only, you know, it's less than a mile off of the highway. So mm-hmm. that does help to a certain extent. And, but yeah, you know, you're right about the, that recognition, you know, certainly Manzanar, Manzanar was the first of the 10 of the War Relocation Authority camps to become a Park Service unit. Mm. They are a National Historic Site. But as is now Tule Lake and Minidoka in Idaho. Mm-hmm. And then the Park Service, it will now be working with Honolulu, which is in Hawaii, which is interesting because the Japanese in Hawaii weren't interned en masse. But there was a prison camp there for nationals that were people who were, you know, they were concerned about them. But right. it was Japanese, Germans, and Italians at Honolulu.
Well, I'm sure, you know, with Pearl Harbor and all that, it was a much more tense situation in Hawaii than most other places.
Yes, but it was also there, you know, about a third of the population of Hawaii were of Japanese descent. And
right.
So the entire island economy would have fallen apart. Plus, there's not the leaders in Hawaii who are calling for the roundup in a way that the leaders on the west coast of the continental U.S. were.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Well, continuing on a little bit with the public archaeology aspect of this thing, you know, the Amache website, amache.org, is pretty good and has a lot of good information. But is there, you know, because this is so remote, you know, for people to get to, and we deal with a lot of archaeological sites, of course, around the world that are remote and difficult to get to. Is there anything on the long-term roadmap? I know the funding is probably not there right now, but on the long-term roadmap to do any sort of virtual things, you know, virtual fly-throughs and things like that, that you can interact with Amache on the web, because maybe you can't get there. Maybe some of the older internees that are still around or their descendants even, you know, or even the children that were in the camp, which I guess would be the older ones now, you know, can't really go there and visit, but could maybe tour it this way. Is there anything on the long-term roadmap for that?
Well, I would hope that, you know, we have many, many plans. I mean, something that happened this summer and that you were involved with was that we created, mm-hmm. We went to a digital survey database right. with Codify. And we're really excited about the possibilities of a front end with that, of where people can see the results of the survey that we did. And they can, you know, for example, you know, appreciate the ingenuity of the Amache internees by looking at 30 different kinds of homemade coal scoops, mm-hmm. For example. So we, you know, we've created that and we're hoping to have a front end of that. There has been, another university here in town, the University of Colorado at Denver, just did some LIDAR work. And so I don't know whether or not there's going to be a public front end on that. Mm-hmm. One of our, basically my map guy, Jim Casey, who does GIS for us, has just, I haven't yet even put it up on our website, but I will after our conversation. Has put together, it's a front end, it's from the public side of ArcGIS, and if you go in and type in the name of someone, it will show you which barrack they lived in. So
okay.
We've finally gotten that, and that's been a long time coming. We went through and very carefully groomed the historic documents, found people's names, and then integrated that into our site GIS. So there's lots of different things that we'd, you know, that we're looking forward to. And so, you know, that we want to make these things more and more available. for exactly those reasons that you're talking about, Chris, that not everybody can get down to the site, and that there are lots of different ways to integrate with the archaeology. You know, something that we always have to be concerned with, of course, is that we are making sure to do this in a way that is, you know, will protect the site and create that, you know, site stewardship, and not encourage people to go out and say, oh, there's all this cool stuff, let's go out and pick it up.
Right, right. Yeah, I think that's good. As we go into break here, I'll just close with one quick comment, because we experience that a lot in the archaeology that I do, cultural resource management archaeology, where we go to a site and, you know, it's been heavily looted, but we use the term looted disparagingly, but it's really just people that went out and were interested in the archaeology and wanted to see the things and didn't know that it was bad or illegal or anything else to pick up the artifact and take it home and put it on their mantle. They just, it's an education thing. So I feel like if we can start by collecting the data the way you're collecting it, so we can have that awesome point data on everything digitally right out of the gate, and then maybe do some infield and or lab photogrammetry on these objects, then people can actually virtually walk across the Yamache landscape and pick these things up where they were left and where they were sitting in situ, and then manipulate them in 3D space pretty easily just with the mouse on their computer, and really have a personal connection with it without even going there. So, and we can finish up that discussion in a couple minutes when we come back from break. The Archaeology Podcast Network's conference channel is a collection of interviews from conferences around the world. Interviews are usually posted during the conference with minimal editing, so you, the listener, can be there virtually. Check out the conference feed at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/conferences. Now let's get back to the show.
All right. Well, we are back from our short break, and we were just leaving off talking about kind of engaging communities and also how you do low impact field work, which is something that the Yamache Project and Bonnie have really been working on and partnering with some other groups to figure out how do we collect more and more data in the field while leaving things as we found them, which is really important at a lot of sites where you do have an engaged community. So Bonnie, can you tell us a little bit more about some of these methods that you're piloting, and the impact that you have seen low impact archaeology having on your research?
Well, you know, one of the things is that, again, knowing that this site is a National Historic Landmark from the get-go, I felt it important. And, you know, there were thousands of people who lived at this site. It was the 10th largest city in Colorado during World War II. And I want people to go out there and have some sense of that. And I think it's really important that we don't mine our archaeological sites of all of the data that makes them interesting, right? And so that's been a long-term commitment from the very beginning to largely leave things in place. And so, but we've also got, the center of the camp is a mile square. And so what we've done is, you know, a commitment to going in and trying to do systematic pedestrian survey on all of the blocks where the former internees lived, as well as then we've been working at some of the public space blocks, like where the elementary school was and where the ball field was. And so so what that means is going in and doing, and this is where my training, you know, I was a CRM archaeologist for a long time. And the thing you do is you count stuff, right? You go in and you're like, okay, what is actually here? So doing that intensive pedestrian survey of really creating a tally for every single block of, and we've decided, and April was actually part of this that first year as we were piloting this, is that we realized because there were these barracks here, and then those were dismantled when the camp was decommissioned. So the camp is built in the summer of 1942, and then it's dismantled in the late fall, early winter of, you know, of 45 and 46. And so there's all of these things that have to do with the buildings. And so what we realized is that if we were going to see the things that were the result of internee behavior, we had to kind of stop looking at architectural remains. And that's, you know, so that was a very specific kind of research methodology that's specific to this site. So it's, unless something has been, obviously it's a modified building material, or it's been used in a different way, like we see an addition to a building, we basically kind of are not looking at that. So, but we literally have, you know, we tally everything as we go along, and then we are flagging items that will basically, you know, the question that we ask our crew is, would it be helpful for us to spend some more time with this? Do we need to, for example, is it a complete enough vessel that we would, you know, be able to know something about what its contents were if we actually took the time to measure it? Does it have a maker's mark? Is it modified? And so all of these objects we flag as we go along, and then we come back. They are further documented, and then they're photographed. And then if there are some things that we really feel like we need to kind of take them back to the field lab and clean them up and really take, you know, much more detailed photographs than we can do in the field, then we do what's called catch and release, just like, you know, you would a fish. And so those are mapped so that we can get them back in case the flag goes away. And then we take them back to the field lab, and then we spend a little bit more time with them. And then our collections, the things that we collect for the long term, you know, I mean, we documented over 16,000 surface artifacts that way this summer. And wow. those are the ones that we actually spent more time with. And we collected, I believe, about 25 surface artifacts out of all of those.
Wow.
So, and those items that we collected are the ones that are going to help us better tell the story of the camp. So they're, you know, sort of they're towards the thought of doing exhibits, as well as the kinds of things that we know from having talked to locals that are that people tend to collect. And so we go in and collect those before someone else can, or things that we really feel like we could learn a lot more if we could spend, you know, additional time with them. And so so that's a very, you know, specifically targeted collection policy to leave most of the things there, to record them in situ. And I know that our descendant community really appreciates that, and I know that, and I really learned these techniques actually from Professor Kent Lightfoot, who developed this kind of protocol when he was doing public work in California, and so at public and community work there, especially at Fort Ross. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I felt that real commitment to that. And then the other thing that we do that's low impact is that we've really made a great use of ground penetrating radar. Mm-hmm. So after we do our intensive survey, let's say we found what looks like a really interesting garden feature that we might want to do a test excavation on, then we do GPR beforehand to make sure that what we think is a garden and not something else, and that it has, you know, that the GPR suggests that it has good physical integrity. And then when we do the archaeology, we are, everything is always a test. So I think about the things that I'm able to do with landscape archaeology, phytolith analysis, palynology, soil chemistry, the kinds of things that I can do now. Many of them weren't possible 20 years ago.
Right.
And 20 years from now, there's going to be a lot more that people can do. And so that soil, especially the garden soil at Amachi, that is an artifact. And that is the result of people who had amazing expertise in growing things and who are in a new environment. And so that soil is very important. And I always want to make sure, first off, I have a little archive sample for every excavation unit we've done, so that if somebody in the future wants to do something that I didn't think of, we have that there. The other is that most of those gardens are still intact. And so, you know, all of our excavations are test excavations. We, you know, most of that site is still there.
Nice. Well, you know, in reference to something you mentioned earlier about artifacts and the descendant communities, one thing I thought was fascinating while you were there is that you can tell by some of the things that were left behind. Because, well, to back up just a little bit, so, you know, people were interned there from around the country, right? It wasn't just different locations or even different, like, neighborhoods, like, say, a lot of them from Los Angeles and things like that. But you can tell from some of the artifacts that were left behind, like, how these communities organized themselves within the camp, right? Can you speak a little bit to that, like, some of the stuff you found that says, oh, these, you know, these came from here, these people came from here, and things like that, and how you tell that through the artifacts?
Well, you know, it comes out in the artifacts, Chris, but it also it really does come out a lot in the landscaping.
Okay.
And actually, April, do you want to talk about about 7-H, where you led the survey? Because I think that's a really good example.
Yeah. So this is actually part of what my research is really interested in, is looking at how communities formed within the internment camps. And so 2 years ago, we surveyed a residential block, 7-H. And this was a really interesting block. A lot of the residents were from kind of more Northern California in these rural agricultural communities. And we found that there was basically a regimented landscaping plan that went throughout the entire residential block. So in front of a lot of the barracks, we find gardens. But in this block, all of the gardens had trees in the exact same position. About, I think it's like 2.5 meters from the front of the barrack and on either side of the doorways into the barracks. And it was consistent. And so that tells us that people in this residential block are working as a neighborhood. They're working as a community, and they have agreed to this landscaping plan, and they're allowing it to be implemented, which tells us about people working together, people forming social bonds, getting along. And we see this too in some of the oral histories and the archive evidence, where different residential blocks had clubs. And so there were, you know, young women's clubs that were for specific residential blocks and neighborhoods. And so you can just sort of picture people learning to meet their neighbors, get along with their neighbors, and forming social activities and really creating a community. Which I think is something that's really interesting and important, because we don't think about places like prisons as homes or areas where you can make friendships, where you can have a community that forms. And so this is really interesting to think about, both in terms of kind of the resiliency of people who are living there, and their ability to take something that's kind of a truly unpleasant situation and turn it into something that's a lot better. And kind of circumnavigate the system in a little bit of a way.
Mm-hmm.
So
it sounds like, it sounds like you can't get away from HOAs no matter what time period you live in. They have.
Yeah, it is sounding a little bit like that when we explain it that way. You know?
Right. Yeah, you will have your trees 2.5 meters away.
Or right. It could have been, you know, we have some examples where we know that a group went out and got trees. Mm-hmm. From along the Arkansas River for their neighborhood and brought them back and then planted them.
Mm-hmm.
In which case you could see something like this kind of standardized design, because yeah. It's the same people sort of doing it. So we don't really know why that neighborhood, but kind of looking at the evidence, it really seems to us like some kind of planning was involved in this.
Well, and that's not a surprise either, really. My sense of Japanese people in general, I actually took Japanese for 2 years in high school, and my sense of them, and you learn about culture and things like that, and while I've never been over there to Japan, you really get the sense that they're a very, in general, orderly and organized and like things a certain way, you know, type of people. I mean, even the Japanese gardens in Seattle is very much like that. We would go there a number of times, and I really like it because that's kind of how I try to be too. So I would have thrived in that sort of environment, you know, the Japanese culture sort of thing. So and it's really neat to see that, you know, even though they were in a terrible situation, you know, they still tried to, you know, bring that personal aspect to it and be as much of themselves as they possibly could.
And yeah, I'm going to jump in here. And to me, that is, in many ways, that's kind of the most important story that we can tell Adamachi, and that the archaeology really shows us is how people came together and how they got on with the business of living, and they did so in a way that mm-hmm. insistently, like, they insisted on their own dignity and on the dignity of their identity as Japanese, you know, at a time when that was not, you know, something that was appreciated by their neighbors outside of the camp. Mm-hmm. It was something that they were not trying to hide in camp, and in fact were really in many ways sort of celebrating. And so you know, that kind of humanity in the face of inhumane conditions is something that the archaeology really brings to light.
Right. And all that being said, we don't want to make it sound like, you know, life was great there, that they loved it. I mean, when they closed that camp, I mean, people scattered and went back to where they were came from. I would imagine they didn't hang out for any longer than they had to, probably.
No, although some people, again, because the laws were such that if you were in many of the Western states, mm-hmm. if you were a first generation Japanese, you were not allowed to become a citizen. Mm-hmm. And so in many states, you were not also allowed to own land. And many people were tenant farmers. And so they had lost their farms. And so then they didn't have much to go back to. And so people had made friends in Colorado and made connections. And so a number of people, yeah, stayed. Whereas others were either lucky enough to go back to their family farms, or they went back home and really, you know, recreated their lives. So it's important not to think of this as a, you know, a sort of shiny, happy place. But I do think that it does tell us that, you know, you don't have to give up when people are oppressing you. And you also don't have to burn things down. I mean, to me, I love the grace of the fact that you have been displaced and you are imprisoned. And what do? You make art. You make things that are beautiful. You make things that that connect you to nature. I mean, it's a fantastic example of how people can do positive things in negative situations.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're about to wrap up, Bonnie. Is there anything that we didn't ask you that you want to mention, or that you just want listeners to take away from this, from listening to this podcast?
I don't necessarily think so. I just would say that, you know, there are over 100 sites that are related to the confinement of Japanese Americans during mm-hmm. World War II. And they need to be protected. If there are people in the U.S. who are listening to this, you're probably not very far from one of these. Mm-hmm. And so, again, and not just that, but the legacy of the World War II home front is something that we should be protecting and doing study on. And I fully believe that 20th century archaeology is archaeology worth doing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, thanks a lot, Bonnie, for coming on. And please be sure to check out the links in our show notes to go see some of these places and at least virtually see them online, and then, you know, maybe go visit them in person. So, again, thanks a lot, Bonnie.
Absolutely.
Thanks for listening to the Archaeology Podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. You can provide feedback using the contact button on the right side of the website at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaeology. Or you can email chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Please like and share the show wherever you saw it so more people can have a chance to listen and learn. Send us show suggestions and follow ArcPodNet on Twitter and Instagram. This show is produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network. Opinions are solely those of the hosts and guests of the show. However, the APN stands by their hosts. This show is edited by Christopher Sims of the Go Dig a Hole podcast. Go check it out. Check out our next episode in 2 weeks. And in the meantime, keep learning, keep discovering new things, and keep listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network. Have an awesome day.
The song I Wish You'd Look by Sea Hero was provided with special permission. Go check them out at seahero.bandcamp.com.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US dollars a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.